Welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. With this podcast, we want to give voices to many coastal scientists and engineers so we can meet them, at least virtually, and hear curious and less curious questions. My name is Ana Vila Concejo, and today I'm having a chat with Colin Woodruff. He's a professor of coastal geomorphology at the University of Wollongong in Australia. I don't think Colin needs much introduction. He has authored books, including the very famous Coasts, Form, Processes and Evolution from 2003. And his interests are the morphology, stratigraphy and sedimentary dynamics of temperate and tropical coasts. Hello, Colin. Thank you very much for being here. How are you?
Hello. Thank you. I'm good, thanks.
As we speak today, we have been in lockdown for a while here in Australia, but there seems to be light at the end of the tunnel as vaccinations increase. How are you coping with the pandemic, Colin?
Yes, I'm coping. I'm looking forward to that light at the end of the tunnel for sure. But yes, I probably have suffered less than many people. Yes, for sure. So obviously, there's been all sorts of disruptions from going into the uni, going to the field, and so on and so forth. But no, I've coped well, thanks.
Okay, so let's go to the podcast. So we have a set of semi-fixed questions to chat about, and we should aim to keep this below half an hour. So let's go for it, yeah?
Yes.
Now, yes, and we also have your timer. There is your clock in the back, yeah? So it's going to time every 15 minutes so we know where we are at.
That's fine.
Okay, so how did you start in coastal science?
Yes, well, I was an undergraduate at Cambridge University studying geography, and the coastal lectures were always fascinating. David Stoddart was an amazing lecturer, and curious thing, at Cambridge, we had tutorials. Can you believe it? So different from what we do today. There were two of us, just two of us sitting in his office for an hour. And I can't remember exactly what we were talking on, but the phone rang and he's talking away on the phone. And he puts the phone down after 10 minutes or something. And he says, oh, we've got this project in the Cayman Islands, so we haven't got anyone to do it. It wasn't as simple as that. There's a long story. I could fill the rest in at some other time. But I ended up doing a PhD under David Stoddart in the Cayman Islands on mangroves.
Wow, that's amazing. What an opportunity. And being in a tutorial with only two people, with David Stoddart, that's incredible.
this was the Cambridge system. How different it is how we teach today. But yes. Yeah.
Okay, so the second question is, how did you balance your life commitments, personal and work?
Oh, I'm not sure if I did. I worked, but I had my wife's an academic too, it was, and now I have two daughters, and now I'm a grandfather, and sure, I believe I have a life out there as well, but clearly the science of the coast is very central to what I do.
And the next question is, if you have any interests or hobbies, what did you do when you're not working? Did you go to the beach?
Oh gosh, I didn't go to the beach. I was already on the beach. Well, you know, the Cayman Islands, I had a fine time. We won't go into all the details, but a beautiful place, you know. I learned to dive and so on. So yeah. But again, you know, coast and the things I was doing has always been very central.
So the next question is about our area of research. I do think that we have a nice area of research full of pretty nice people, but there are obviously changes that we would like to see. So what would you change in our area of research to make it a better place?
Oh gosh, it's hard to imagine it being a better place. It's a great place. And I've been so fortunate, so privileged in that I've been able to work, now that I think about it and reflect back on so many different types of coasts. So I already indicated that looking at mangroves, which wasn't, these are a mosquito infested. In fact, I was working with the Mosquito Research and Control Unit. So, you know, I was out there swatting mosquitoes as I worked in the mangroves. But then the enticing coral reefs generated an interest in coral reefs. And since then, I've had the opportunity to work on cliff coastlines, on estuaries, on sandy coastlines. So I've been very fortunate, which I think is something it's much harder these days to be so general across such a broad range of coastal types. And I guess that's one of the things that I tried to capture and feel that I had particular privilege to be able to review in the book on coasts, because I had felt that, well, I have worked in each of the different coastal types, which has been fantastic.
So would you advocate for early career researchers and students to try to be a bit more general and look at different parts of the coast, or is that?
I think it's much harder to do that today. I think one really needs to specialize in a sense. I certainly, I would encourage, yes. If there's the opportunity to be able to diversify like that, it's certainly been one of the things that's been so great in what I've done. But I could see how much harder it is. There's so much more literature. There's so much more need to specialize, to become focused, so much more focused. Now, I think it's been a wonderful privilege of perhaps an earlier generation in many ways to be able to be so broad.
Yes, I agree with you. I think I'm not a particularly focused person, and perhaps my career would have been better being more focused, but at the same time, I do enjoy being unfocused. So, okay, the next question is, can you tell us about your favorite paper, or a paper that changed your life or research direction?
That would be very difficult because of that breadth I've just indicated in so many ways. I come back to the Wright and Tom paper in 1977, that the morphodynamics, I think, you know, that paper still seems to say so much to what we do today as well. But of course, there are these key papers in each of those different spheres I just indicated. Indeed, I seem to recall starting my chapters in each of those thematic chapters in that book with something of a revisit of the past, because I think that's something we so rarely do in reality, and ask ourselves, why is it that we study these systems in the way we do? You know, how did Peter Roy's evolution of estuaries model come about? Well, it came about from that tendency to look back at this concept of a life cycle for landforms, an early stage, a mature stage, a senile stage, and so on. So, it's interesting to understand our present understanding in the context of those studies that went before and set the foundations and have, in some ways, provided a rut, that's the wrong word, but you know what I mean. They've channeled the way that we look at things into a particular way, which has not always been logical of thinking about, of course, the life cycle of a particular coastal landform that has a long tradition.
Yes, that is very interesting. And I agree, that is something that we need to understand. Okay, now the next question. Can you briefly explain one of your topics of research to our listeners?
I'm interested. Let's follow a thread for a moment. In the Cayman Islands, as I looked at those mangroves, I was coring into them to try and understand how they developed. And I suppose what we wanted to look at there, or what came out of it, was the fact that the sea had been rising and the mangroves had formed these deeper peaks as the sea had risen. And I went on to be part of that group of people who looked at reconstructing what sea level had done. And there was a great interest because, well, slowly it was dawning on people that the sea level hadn't done the same everywhere around the world. So you can now appreciate the relevance of research. It wasn't terribly relevant at the time to anything other than that particular study. But now, as we talk about sea level rise and as we realize that the sea is rising at an accelerating rate, then how the coast will respond becomes an even more important issue. And of course, it becomes important for all those other coastal types I've indicated I've got an interest in. But I am going back at the moment again to my colleagues here at Wollongong, Kerry Lee Rogers and Sarah Hamilton, to look at mangroves again in greater detail and how they respond to these more subtle changes of sea level and how they will respond in the future as the sea level rises. And mangroves might seem rather esoteric to many non-coastal people, but there's a far bigger story too, because the coastal plains that these mangroves occur on are the same coastal systems the great mega deltas of Asia and so on and so forth have developed in the same kind of way. And as the sea rises, there are these enormous flat low-lying areas that are going to be extremely vulnerable as the sea level rises, vulnerable to inundation and storm damage and so on. So there's been an interesting, I wouldn't say continuity, because I've looked at many other things in as well, but some of that early research has a new relevance.
Yes, I remember when I was a student in Europe and like thinking about mangroves, like it was really, really esoteric, I have to say. And when I first saw them in the end, it's just like, oh, is this? I don't know what I was expecting.
But funnily enough, it was a very esoteric subject in Cambridge too. I remember at a point, I think I was presenting the stunning results of my PhD in an internal seminar at the University of Cambridge, and the person who was chairing it said, that's really interesting. It's really good to hear about these mangoes.
I love it. Okay, so this follows nicely with the next question. That is, what are the wildest field conditions that you have encountered?
Having just told you how relevant this research is to the mega deltas with the mega cities and the mega populations on them, I must confess that most of the places I've worked in have been wild, have been natural. And I suppose the wildest, it's hard to, they're all wild, but it would involve the sea and small boats, I think. Probably Saguaro, a remote atoll in the Northern Cook Islands, an uninhabited atoll. Well, actually, it had a population of one for a long time. A fellow called Tom Neal, an amazing story. He lived there on his own for a couple of years, and he actually did his back on a remote one of the islands and struggled back to his little hut and lay there. And there was a ship that visited about, you know, once a year or something. Occasionally somebody would come. And fortunately, somebody arrived while he was in this condition and took him away and to Rarotonga. And ironically, he came back and lived another 15 years on the island. Anyway, and my wild experience was, well, after Tom Neal had was no longer on the island, his little hut was there, but We had a little expedition there. We lived there for 4 weeks and camped on the island. I was frightened out of my tent by rats at night. I eventually had to go and sleep on the beach because the wild rats, the Polynesian rats, they were infested the island. And I seem to recall a pretty hairy moment. We wouldn't be able to do this today with occupational health and safety. We're out on some remote reef island at the far side of the atoll, and of course the boat motor won't start and all these sorts of things. So yeah, there have been some boppages. There have been many of these instances which are better not referred to the occupational health and safety team these days, but there have been some scary moments, I guess.
I have to say that after some of the stories that we're hearing in the podcasts about the field conditions, one has to be grateful for occupational health and safety.
Yes, I suppose I can say that less able to go in the field these days and perhaps more conscious that there's a need for some sort of backup and so on, yes.
Following up on that question, and you might have answered already that, but you might have other stories. What is the strangest thing that you have seen at the coast?
Dear me, I nothing immediately occurs to me as being strange at this point.
I thought the story of Tom Neal was pretty strange.
Well, it was lovely to see his hut, and I I didn't rifle through the various papers that were there as much as perhaps I should have done or shouldn't have done. The coconut crabs that crawled around were pretty scary, catching one of those and for our collection. Oh, actually catching the rats for our collection as well was all a bit, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It's good this is a podcast because my face at the moment, just at the mention of rats, is not good. Okay, going back to science. Do you think that we can predict long-term morphodynamic changes beyond decadal scales?
Yes and no. Broadly, we if the sea rises by 2 meters, we can say some things fairly confidently about which areas will be underwater and so on and so forth. But the details, I think we still inevitably, these are things that are contingent on particular storms and particular events and so on that occur. So, but I think it's a very important point. I think, why do we do our science and what do we do? We play around with those polished pebbles on the beach and make a story out of them, which I think is a magnificently enjoyable thing. But I guess what some of the greatest satisfying experiences that I've had in research have been where I have understood something and where I can actually say, I understood this now. I suddenly realized that this particular facies, this particular type of sediment occurs in this environment and that one occurs there. And if I go around the corner, it's going to change. It's going to be to this. And you go around the corner and wow, this is right. Suddenly I've got, so this is an element of understanding that allows an element of prediction or forecasting. But in those long term, well, yeah. I've just read a book, and you can ask me about books in a moment. I've just read a book called The End of Everything. Astrophysically speaking, was the sort of in brackets was the subtitle, and it indicates that these astrophysicists have no idea whether the Big Bang is going to end in the Big Crunch or the or we're all going to go through a wormhole or anything else. So, in the long term, the future's unknown. But what our science does is gives us greater confidence in the range of things we might be able to say. The fantastic outcome for science over the last year or two has been, of course, the development of these vaccines. If we were having this interview a couple of years ago, we would have been at a time when science was being ridiculed almost around the world. The view of science and scientific opinion was very low, but there could be no firmer confirmation of what our scientific colleagues, their sincerity and their genuine, their integrity and so on, as we see the development of these vaccines, absolutely remarkable.
As we progress in science, we're also improving our science communication, the way we communicate science and the way we communicate uncertainty, yeah? Because there is no completely 100% yes or 100% no, and the response to a given question is going to change depending on the data that you get. So I think we're doing a better job now. It's not perfect, but science communication is improving.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so now you can get your crystal ball, Colin, and think forward. What can you think of a major advance in coastal science that will happen in the next 50 years?
No, I couldn't possibly. I mean, interestingly, I reflect back, I think one of your colleagues, Peter Cowell, I remember sort of talking about this, and he's sort of, saying 50 years ago or 100 years ago, how much the world has changed. The development of the car and the plane and the concept of we've been sort of talking 100 years ago about how the world was going to develop, we all had no idea. And over the past 50 years, that great acceleration has been even more rapid than Will Steffen's term, the great acceleration, and that's the period that I've lived through, and the changes have been enormous. The great hopes for the future and so on. I mean, just what we can do with remote sensing and things these days, it's remarkable.
It is indeed remarkable. You could use this question also as a wish list if you want to say something that you really want to see developed. Like, I would like to see remote sensing that actually sees through water, but like through all of the water, not just shallow water, and breaking waves that sees through everything.
this is likely to happen. It's interesting. If I follow up on that sort of story again of a kid on the shoreline, you know, distracted by a mangrove out of the corner of my eye, or a cliff line over here, or estuary behind me, or coral reef in front. And during lockdown last year, during the COVID, the Schmidt Ocean Institute operated its RV Falkor. This is a charitable organization, essentially, philanthropic science. And they weren't able to take scientists on board, but the vessel was operating out there out in the Coral Sea, collecting data that some of us, I wasn't one of the prime ones, but the science team was online listening and indicating where to deploy the multi-beam and so on and so forth. Well, you know, as we watch the rovers walking around Mars, we realize what a privileged time we live in, and how these opportunities these dreams are, the potential for them to become real is better than it has ever been.
Yeah, I watched a few of the immersions of the rover with my kids. Real time. And it's just fascinating. It's like they're not just doing it. They're also like all of this, again, science communication, having them online for everyone to watch. It's incredible. Some of them were a bit boring. There was nothing to be seen, but some of them were fascinating.
That's pretty about mine not being on board.
Okay, the next question is about our contributions to society. Did you do something through your work or not that you contribute to society in terms of science communication, mentoring, outreach? Is there something?
Yes, indeed, sure. Yes, I'm chair of the Commission on Coastal Systems at the moment, but I suppose the thing that most is the IPCC. I was a lead author for the IPCC for that fourth assessment report, which was the one for which the IPCC, along with Al Gore, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. So, and I enjoyed very much working in those, or previously also in LOICS, which was the Land Ocean Interactions in the Coastal Zone. Look, I think one of the other great rewards in coastal science is being able to mentor the younger generation. I take enormous pride in my postgrad students and postdocs and colleagues. I mean, it's great working as a team and really satisfying when these far brighter individuals go ahead and do all these exciting things. And if you're able to provide them some direction and encouragement, that's a wonderful thing.
Finally, the last question. What was the best or worst advice that you ever received? Or another way to say is, what would you tell to your former self if you were starting?
Oh, gosh. Well, look, I would actually follows on just what I've said. Now that I think about it, how appreciative I've been of four great mentors that I've had. And I really think the value of mentors is amazing. For me, David Stoddart, then I was at Auckland, the University of Auckland, at the same time as Roger McLean was there. I moved to the Australian National University and worked with John Chappell, and through John had the opportunity to work with Bruce Tong. And those four individuals have had an enormous influence on my career and so on. So mentors have been wonderful, and I appreciate the advice they've given. It's been fantastic.
That's good. Okay, so we're reaching now the end of the podcast. Before going to our final quick questions, is there something that you would like to say that you haven't had a chance of saying?
Yes, there is, actually. I really want to sound a note of hope and optimism. for people who perhaps feel in some despair at the moment as we go through such a challenging time. I had a near tragic accident in the middle of my career, and I ended up in a hospital and a wheelchair, and I've been very fortunate to be able to get out of that. And I managed to redesign my career in some ways by becoming interested in GIS and mapping and so on. And in the same kind of way, I sort of see the opportunity as remote sensing becomes so much more available. Again, I really would like to shout out the great opportunities the future offers, and it offers it for so many people for so many ways. So it's a wonderful world we live in, and it's enormous fun finding out about it. And I really would encourage those of you who find that fascinating and interesting too, to pursue that interest. We need you.
I love those words, Colin. Thank you so much for sharing. Now, our final quick questions to wrap up. Don't think too much. Just give me the first answer that comes to your mind. So, first one, favorite band, music, or composer?
Oh, I'm a right nerd. I listen to classical music on the radio every day. And my students must think I'm a... I have no real favorites. I guess Bach is enormous. Yes, how lovely to listen to Bach.
And favorite dish or signature dish?
Look, I fondly remember my time in Thailand, and Thai food is in my mind the best food in the world. But I'm pretty. I come from England, so I don't have great culinary. Yours are differentiating. Yeah.
Okay. The latest book you read.
Ah, now here's a question I could answer in. We've got a lot. How long have you got? Right. I'm a great reader of books. I really recommend David Attenborough's Witness. It was a fantastic read. I've enjoyed reading Charlie Veron's Life Underwater. And I've actually enjoyed reading Peter Ridd's Reef Heresy. I think I told you I've been reading about the end of everything. I'm into another cosmological book at the moment. Love Simon Winchester, his Land, or almost any other book he's ever written. There's lots of books. And if anyone's got any good books you think I should read, please let me know. I'm looking for the next one or two.
Take care. You might get this might go viral, and you might get like millions of emails with recommendations.
Well, that's right. Well, I'm not going to spend enough time to read them.
Okay. What is the weirdest thing on your desk right now?
Well, there's a lot here, to be honest, but I've got a mud lobster. This is a Thalassina anomala, I think it's called. We were working in the Alligator River. I recall we were boating along the river bank, and I was the one at the front of the boat. I had to jump out to kind of secure the boat while down by my feet, there's a couple of little pincers. And someone said, better look out, there's a crab down there or something. I shift around and put it up, and it's a little rock with a pincer sticking out of it. And there were lots of these. This was part of what we called the Big Swamp, the 6,000-year-old mangrove unit. And these mud lobsters that had lived in those areas had calcified, with little calcite accretions around them. A fascinating thing. You know, we found them all over the place. And there were other little bits and pieces that similarly had calcified in that sense. That was pretty curious.
So you kept one.
A few more than one, but they're not all on my desk.
Okay. Okay. Your favorite movie?
No, I pass on that one.
Pass on movies? Okay. Mm. You gave us many.
I can't remember. I couldn't. There wouldn't be more than four movies I'd seen twice. So I can't. To me, that's a story, and that's it. Once you never really think about the deeper meanings of, in contrast to, say, perhaps theatre or whatever, but movies are just passing entertainment, I think. Maybe I'm missing something.
Finally, coffee or tea?
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I have several cups of tea a day, but for me, coffee, like beer, is a social drink. And it's been too long since the last one of either of them, to be honest. We need to get out of lockdown.
Yeah, there is light in the end of the tunnel. Colleen, we'll get there. Okay, so that is it. Thank you very much, Colleen. It has been great having you in Coast to Coast. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. My pleasure.